Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
I'm Deep Singh, founder and CEO of CreditLink.ai.
You're on the other side of the world right now in Singapore, and that's, I believe, almost 9:30 p.m. at night. So I appreciate making the time and join us. Before we get started and talk about all of the great things you're building at CreditLink, maybe give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Yeah, quite unique and varied. I started my career working at Coca-Cola, actually, which was really in the operations and logistics space. Helped me understand a brick and mortar business and a marketing business end to end. And of course, as every good career path would, money has a calling to it. So in 2008, I actually decided that it was a great idea to join the banking sector. So I joined ANZ Bank out of Australia in January 2008. Well-timed, because of course that was probably the inflection point at which the global financial crisis was just falling into full swing. And in hindsight, it was actually a great period in my time, in my life and in my career, because it actually allowed me to see through a credit cycle, and it helped navigate, you know, both the positive trends that happen in macro environments, but also some of the downturns that people will face through their careers. Spent 5 years with them. They were generous enough to actually relocate me to Singapore, where I helped set up two specific businesses, one of them being the structured export finance business. And having spent some time with them, I thought it was an opportunity to actually widen the net a little bit more and work for a larger organization. So I ended up joining Bank of America Merrill Lynch, where I ended up spending 5 years growing both the export finance business and the loan distribution business. We ended up peaking at about 15 billion of loan distributions, which actually made us the third largest bank in the world. It was a great experience, again, formative years in my career. But of course, the entrepreneurial itch was there. So I wanted to do something different and unique. So I joined a boutique credit hedge fund and spent 3.5 years there and worked my way up through various roles, becoming the chief capital officer and board director. So one of the three leaders in the firm. And we ended up scaling that business to 1.5 billion of assets under management. And of course, as with the positive trends, one of the negative trends came through, and that was a health crisis that the world had never seen before. And that was really COVID, which effectively transformed the credit hedge fund I was at, just on the basis that it was open funds. It was a credit market. Investors got nervous and started to redeem. So the call was, do I stick around and try to scale the business back, or do I spin out and take advantage of the crisis that's there? And that's what myself and my team did. We ended up starting CreditLink.ai out of the COVID crisis. And then, of course, have navigated a number of different opportunities, but also challenges in the last couple of years as we've scaled.
Very bright and diverse career background. Thank you for sharing that. So tell us a little bit more about the problem or the opportunity you saw in the market when you decided to start CreditLink, and what is that particular problem that CreditLink is aiming to solve?
Yeah, brilliant. So the way we pitch our business is we're a technology infrastructure company that supports B2B platforms to enable embedded finance on a white label basis. Now, if we just break that down and link it back into the problem statement, one of the things that happened during COVID was a huge acceleration of offline to online. Now, that's a trend that's been there for an extended period of time. But because people were forced to move online, you started seeing more businesses sprout up in e-commerce and in payments, in procurement, in supply chain, because there was no other way to do business other than online, because the physical presence wasn't available to you. So what that meant was that transformation was accelerated from offline to online. Now, what happens during that period of time is you start creating more and more rich data, more and more history between suppliers and buyers interacting across various verticals. And what I saw as I was transitioning out of the credit hedge fund into CreditLink AI was really an opportunity to capitalize on alternative data to drive credit decisioning, particularly utilizing techniques like machine learning, as well as AI, artificial intelligence, neural networks, and so forth. Now, that buzzword has obviously caught on in the last 6 to 12 months as a result of OpenAI and ChatGPT, but we've been building those models for the last couple of years already. And a function of it really was, how do you start automating and scaling a business that can analyze data and decision quickly, and therefore deploy capital to those people that need it online in platform? So in a traditional sense, you would move offline, go to a bank or a capital provider to find credit, usually submitting your financial statements or bank statements. Today, you can actually stay in the platform that you're operating, whether it's in payments or e-commerce or procurement. And right there and then, you can actually get instantaneous access to capital. And that's actually what's been the success, because we've solved a number of problem statements. It's a problem statement for the person or the individual and business seeking capital. It's a problem statement for the platforms themselves, because they don't need to build their own technology infrastructure around credit decisioning, and more importantly, bringing capital to the table to fund those opportunities as well.
Tell us a little bit more about the very early stages of the company formation and kind of some of the strategies that you have deployed that have worked well, or maybe something that did not work, and some of the lessons learned throughout that process when you were trying to do that market validation, that product market fit, very early stages. Maybe walk us through some of those early times of building CreditLink.
Yeah, of course, with any good business, there's always a pivot. So we did spend the first 6 to 7 months of our life really thinking about how do you optimize workflow and automation with regards to giving a loan to an SME. And what we realized in that scenario was the client acquisition cost was far too high. You were going from merchant to merchant to merchant, acquiring their data, and therefore underwriting based on that information. At that point, we were still looking at bank statements as a way to optimize that decisioning. What we realized very quickly was that you were now competing against peer-to-peer lending platforms. You were getting bucketed into a digital lending platform. You weren't necessarily being valued on technology. You were valued on book size. And more importantly, we weren't really addressing the challenge that the broader market was having, which is how do you bring credit expertise, decisioning, technology infrastructure within an embedded finance environment? So as we kind of hit those headwinds around, hey, the cost of acquisition here feels really high. Hey, we're now being compared to a market that we don't necessarily feel we fit in, nor do we want to participate in. And then very quickly through feedback from a number of different market participants on the platform side, we realized, they've got a problem statement. They want to offer a lending product both for their suppliers and buyers, but don't know how. Why don't we take this technology stack that we've built around automation and decisioning? How do we take platform ecosystem data and plug that into our algorithms to actually optimize decisioning? So it was a very decisive step that we took in early on to really navigate and leverage on network effects. The network effect of one single e-commerce platform having thousands of suppliers and buyers interacting, or a payment processing firm or a merchant acquirer who's got thousands of merchants and thousands of buyers interacting or receiving payments. So that was pretty transformative in my view in terms of leading to success. And one of the first clients we ended up winning was a publicly listed company. And the reason for that was we had already built all of the tech stack because we were planning on using it ourselves. So it was already prepared to be implemented for someone else.
When we talk about building out that technology stack, or essentially that first version of your MVP, tell us a little bit more about the thought process there. Were you trying to build something more comprehensive before you went to market, or were you going hand in hand and talking to some of the potential clients and adjusting the functionality, the platform, all of that stuff along the process as you started essentially selling or introducing the market to the services that you were providing? Curious to get your take a little bit further on, as we talk to a lot of entrepreneurs who are building technology platforms, and a lot of the debate that goes on is whether to try to build something that's comprehensive, that's market ready, or go work hand in hand with the clients as you're trying to refine the functionality and essentially potentially pivot. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think we went down both paths, which is we built something fairly comprehensive. And then as we went and started implementing it and working with clients, we got tremendous amounts of feedback. So we did have to make changes. I don't think it was necessarily punitive to our trajectory or to our growth. Because what it taught us was that you could actually build a product beyond an MVP stage that just needed to be polished and modified slightly, rather than building an MVP product and having to fulfill a larger gap when you had to meet a client's requirements. So I think in both ways, we were a bit slower than expected. And I think we got punished a little bit in our first 6 or 12 months in being assessed from a product market fit and traction perspective. But to the same extent, when we started winning clients, they were large and sizable. To the extent now we're live with 6 platforms across 6 different markets, and 2 of them happen to be publicly listed companies. So I think in essence, we took a fairly balanced approach. The nature of our team is that we are very much mature founders. We come with tremendous experience. And what that meant was that we had a view and we followed that view. But I think what entrepreneurship has taught us and what market feedback has taught us is to be a little bit more flexible and a little bit more willing to actually adapt, particularly through navigating some of the challenges that weren't necessarily there prior to COVID. Things like logistics and supply chain issues. How do you manage and monitor those as part of your risk analytics? Or even interest rates going up by 500 basis points in less than 12 months. No one could have predicted the rate of those increases. And therefore, how does your pricing model adjust to interest rate environments as well?
Paint a picture for me of a company or a, you know, a customer that would benefit the most from the services that CreditLink provides. The reason I ask is also because majority of the audience of Ivy Podcast and kind of the all of the episodes that we produce are US-based companies, a lot of technology executives, a lot of C-levels from Fortune 500 organizations. And we love introducing different solutions as such as CreditLink from the different markets that potentially may not have significant presence in the US, but at the same time, there's not also, you know, a lot of competition in that sector potentially. So maybe tell us a little bit more about the type of company that has the most potential to be successful utilizing CreditLink, and what are some of those advantages?
Yeah, brilliant. That's a great question. Let's pick a couple of use cases and how they apply to both developed and developing markets, right? So let's think about e-commerce today. There's wonderful platforms like Anchor Store out of Europe or Fair, F-A-I-R-E, out of the US. Got thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of wholesalers and hundreds of thousands of buyers who are buying on wholesale pricing. Now, what's been fascinating in that space is that you've gone from very large markets in terms of size and scale to smaller niches, to the extent there's now particular e-commerce websites tailored just for buying pet food or pet meats, or it might be specific to wholesaling of sneakers, and that's all they do. So what we've realized is that all of those necessary scales need to be addressed. So what you end up seeing is that the big boys like an Anchor Store or a Fair are able to orchestrate their embedded finance experience by building it themselves or partnering up with some of the larger incumbents. But it's really hard to access the same service if you're a much smaller boutique e-commerce platform with a particular niche. So in some sense, what we're really targeting is same user experience, the same outcome, but for clients who don't necessarily have access to get that system or that technology implemented. So let's just go into that use case in a bit more detail. So wholesalers want to generate volume. Buyers want to buy at the best price, but when they buy, they're holding inventory. They need to make that a sale, convert that sale to cash, and therefore go back on platform to purchase more. Now, if you can read the historical transactional data between a supplier and a buyer who's had a repeat history over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 months, whatever it may be, and you can see the level of prediction that you can create from historical data, you can see at what point they're going to come back and how much they're going to purchase. And of course, there's a degree of volatility and variance in that. But if you can fund them for 70% of their purchases, what you've done is you've actually allowed them to hold more inventory, potentially actually sell at a better price because your weighted average cost of capital has gone down, convert to cash, pay us back for the funding they've utilized, and keep the commercial margin, which is actually going to be higher because they're driving volume. What that means for the seller is that they were able to sell more. What it means for the platform, they were able to deliver a higher GMV and potentially higher valuation for themselves. And for the buyer, they were able to stock more and sell more at an optimized price, which allowed the end user to actually purchase a potentially a better outcome as well. So the entire supply chain of buyers and sellers actually benefit from our solution.
So
now, whether that's an e-commerce platform in Indonesia or one in the US or Australia, it doesn't actually matter.
So to double click on that, as an example, let's say a mid-sized merchant on one of those platforms, e-commerce platforms, seeking some type of a credit line, or maybe payroll funding mechanism. What would be the difference, or what would be the advantage for them to go to CreditLink versus to a traditional mainstream lender, such as maybe Bank of America as an example? Maybe tell us a little bit more about that difference.
Yeah, I think let's focus in on that use case itself. Right, we've got a wonderful platform that we work with in Australia, and this is in the locum space. And a locum is a temporary pharmacist, doctor, or nurse who's being placed into an emergency shift because someone is sick or they've gone on holidays for 3 to 4 days. They can't make a particular shift for family reasons, whatever it may be. What happens in the traditional model is that the hospital, the pharmacy, will call up an agency to find an emergency locum. Now, these agencies charge an exorbitant amount, usually $200 or $300 per shift, whether the shift is 5 hours or 10 hours, but then they also take a percentage of the day, right? So what ends up happening is that the locum is actually getting less money and the hospital or the pharmacy is having to pay more money. So there's inherent tension. We've got a particular platform in Australia where they figured out, let's displace the agencies. Let's ask pharmacies to put in all of their available shifts on our app. Let's get all of the pharmacists registered and ping them using a geolocation saying, hey, these shifts are available within a particular radius. Well, please log in and see where shifts are available and start matching at $50 per shift. But what ends up happening when you do a shift at a place where you've not worked before is you get onboarded and the app does that for you. But after you've completed your shift, you lodge your hours as a pharmacist. The pharmacy accepts that you work those hours, including your break and overtime, whatever it may be. But then they're not going to pay you until the payroll kicks in. Mm-hmm. And if you did the shift on the 2nd of November, on say May, and payroll is the 28th of every month, it's 26 days you've got to wait for your money for a firm you've never worked before, where you only worked once, right? No, that's pretty tough. So we have a pay now solution where we allow the pharmacist to assign that invoice to us. So we're buying their debt. We pay them the face value immediately with a 2% discount charge. And then we actually wait for the pharmacy to pay us 26 days later. So it's a great example of a particular use case where a Bank of America Merrill Lynch is not going to participate because they're not going to underwrite an $800 invoice for a pharmacy and or a pharmacist. So the point is that our cost of acquisition, because we're embedded in that app and as part of the user experience, is very, very low. It's fractional to the dollar effectively, because as soon as they press the button, we trigger a code base that moves money from a digital wallet into the money of the locum. And then we collect money once the pharmacy pays into the app, and the code base again triggers money down to our digital wallet. So the entire workflow is optimized through code base, and it actually allows for a seamless experience for the locum, for us, for the app, as well as the pharmacy. It's really hard to credit underwrite and get your cost of acquisition to underwrite a client of that nature. Now, if you think about banks, the reason they have an SME vertical, a commercial banking vertical, an institutional vertical, a government vertical, is because they're saying, hey, what resources do I need to allocate to go and acquire that customer? And what support base do you need to serve that customer, right? It's really hard to acquire and serve small clients, and hence why they're generally underbanked or unbanked.
That makes a lot of sense. And thanks for that breakdown. Crystal clear at this point. So what's next for CreditLink? Where do you see this going? What are some of the maybe short-term to mid-term plans for you guys as you guys scale and grow?
Yeah, great question. I think we're really focused on the true concepts of venture capital, right? Which is what do you need to deliver? Have you delivered product market fit? Tick. Now, have you entered particular markets or verticals? Tick. Now, have you scaled them? And once you scale them, can you repeat it? And can you make it profitable? So we're at that inflection point as we're moving from a seed stage company to a Series A to start accelerating growth through a repeatable and profitable business model. And one of the strategies we've decided to deploy is that we have great expertise in verticals across payments, procurement, supply chain, payroll financing, to say, let's go to a variety of different countries to tackle that solution. So we're now live in Singapore, Hong Kong, Australia, Malaysia, Indonesia effective last Friday, and we're looking to go into Vietnam. But more importantly, we've put business development teams in place across Europe, targeting the UK, Ireland to Spain to begin with, and then subsequently Netherlands and Belgium, and then we'll continue on. Then of course, we're right now looking at access to the US. So we've started the process to put in place business development representatives, but to replicate some of the existing use cases that we already have in that market. I think once we can prove that our technology is scalable across a variety of different countries, across those specific verticals where we've built specialization, the repeatability, scalability, and the profitability metrics start flowing through.
As a founder and the CEO of a growing company, one of the most important aspects of that, at least the way I see it, and I have an ongoing debate with a lot of other entrepreneurs, other investors in my industry and so forth, regarding, you know, if you were to choose the most important responsibility of a CEO, of course, it's various degrees, you know, you play this full, but if you were to choose one, I always identify recruiting and surrounding yourself with the top talent as the most important, kind of top of the line, if there was only one task that we were to choose. So that's the ongoing debate that I have with a lot of my circles. And question for you is around your process, your strategies, practical recommendations that you execute on a daily basis to build that winning team. How do you recruit? And more importantly, also, how do you retain the top talent? Tell us a little bit more about that process, about your essentially things that work well for you.
Yeah, I link it back to a great TED talk I heard from Bill Gross. Right. So he's gone ahead and analyzed so many of the companies that were within the portfolio that he's worked in to identify some of those traits, right? Is it timing? Is it the idea? Is it the level of funding? Or is it the team? Right. And you know, that's resonated with me. This is a talk from about 7 or 8 years ago, and I've watched about 6 or 7 times. And the part that stands out and that's transformative is the quality of the team. Right. And of course, timing matters, the amount of funding you have matters, but it's not as necessarily as important. So my view going into building this organization was, how do you build the right capabilities and the right talent? So what we did was we really focused in on what are the core drivers of success: really great data science and analytics, really great credit underwriting, really great asset and risk management. So what we've done is we've hired the greatest people we could find, both within our network and broader network within those domains. So when you think about data analytics and technology infrastructure, one of the best firms in the market is Experian. Our CTO was the CTO at Experian in India, data analytics, credit decision side. Now, if you think about the Experian business, India has the largest user base because, of course, all the individual credit underwriting that gets done. When I think about data science, machine learning, and quantitative finance, Moody's comes to mind, particularly the Moody's Analytics business. So our chief data scientist, Priyan Fernando, comes from Moody's Analytics, working on the quant finance side. When I thought about SME lending and risk, my co-founder is Vikram, who's the former global head of SME lending product for Standard Chartered Bank. Right. So we made sure that we started putting in the puzzle pieces for a very strong foundation, because from that foundation is where you build the business, and hence why we spent so much time recruiting some of the best talent. Now, of course, it wasn't easy, you know, convincing them to leave their wonderful and great jobs and to sell them a vision that they believe in. The way I pitched it is, you've bet your career and your brand and your traction and your delivery on an organization. Now it's time to actually bet on yourself and build the organization. And that's how we live every day, that we have a huge degree of confidence in each other. We have a huge amount of responsibility that's bestowed upon us by our VC investors, by our client base, but more importantly, each other. When we can start policing each other a bit more independently, holding each other to account, and yet to have huge amounts of friction, I think we always have a good hearty debate and bring huge amounts of conversation and debate to the table and really move forward, you know that you're going to move forward in a powerful direction.
So pull the thread a little bit further. You've mentioned conflict management in creating that environment where everyone feels comfortable sharing, you know, their honest opinions and thoughts. Tell us a little bit more about some of the tactics or strategies that really help you maintain that level of conflict, but at the same time, be productive in the conversation where you have different levels of disagreements with peers or the subordinates or whatever the case is. Give us some examples of how you work through that.
Yeah, I'd say we've not had any degree of conflict. I think we've had good, hearty debates where people have brought their ideas to the table and really hashed out why they think they're right and what they know and what the gaps may be, right? I think what we do is we take away tremendous amount of learning from each other because we all have blind spots, right? And I think when you can rely on the professionalism of the people to bring those blind spots in a manner which isn't defensive or aggressive, it allows you to have a bit more of a constructive conversation, which is, hey, I'm thinking about going down this path. And someone says, well, hang on, have you thought about this? And have you thought about this? And by the way, this piece is missing, or maybe you've missed something with regards to considering this. And that's really allowing you to shape a decision, but you are building a consensus, but you've already set the direction, if that makes sense. And I think we're really great in someone taking a call and saying, hey, this is the direction, and starting to build a consensus around that. But that consensus is driven by all of the inputs that have gone in. I don't think we're perfect. Of course, we have tremendous amounts of learning to do in terms of how we grow as we get bigger, going from 8 people to 15 and now to 21. How do you manage the organization in that style and in that way when you're 200? And I think that's still part of our development path that we'll get to, but it's not perfected as yet.
One of the aspects that was very impressive for me when we've met in person in your offices in Singapore and some of your teammates was how diverse the team dynamics were and how everyone is so different, but at the same time, everyone seemed to be very well aware of each other's strengths and weaknesses and how they complement each other. So that really stood out to me, which begs, you know, further question on, give us an insight into your interview process. What are some of the questions that you ask potential candidates that allows you to extract that type of information out of them and maybe reveal their personalities, reveal their character in general that makes you, gives you that enough of the intel to make some of those decisions, whether that's a right fit for the company or not. Maybe give us some examples of the questions you ask, or more importantly, what do you look for in the responses when you go through that interview process?
Yeah, that's a really tough question because I'm probably as least structured in my interview process as you could probably imagine. And the reason for that is what I try to do is I try not to navigate a path that people may know or have walked before, because you can orchestrate answers in that, right? So what we try to do is be a little bit unique and different. And I mean, just coming back to your earlier point around the diversity, we're absolutely passionate about that, right? We've made sure we've brought amazing people from all around the world. Our team is located across 6 countries. We have an amazing amount of languages that we all speak, the color that we are, the experience we've had, the number of countries we've worked in. But you have to be a real bearer of the culture of the organization. So, you know, something we take a huge pride in is that every time we bring in someone new, someone who needs to understand who we are and what our culture is, we make sure we're all active in it. And, you know, one of the benefits of a globally diverse organization is you can actually bring people together every so often. So one of the things we do every 6 months is we try to pick a location where we could fly everyone in for 3 or 4 days. And of course, as a startup, we make sure they're cheap locations across Asia, because we can actually go to grassroots level and understand some of the challenges faced in those countries for our clients, for our users, but also bring everyone together in a space where we can all understand who we are, how we operate, and really build chemistry and trust. Because I think in the world that we operate today, where organizations are very dispersed and global, when you're large, it's really hard to bring that cultural aspect together in one spot. And I think we want to take the most advantage we can whilst we're still small in doing that. But to the more formal point is, what's the interview process like? Well, seldom have we advertised for roles. What we've done is we've gone through our network and the network within our network to say, hey, this is a role we're seeking. This is a specialization we need. Who's available and who's interested? And more recently, we've started advertising roles and started getting amazing candidates. And, you know, the most recent example is we were looking for a chief product officer, but we found two amazing candidates. And we realized that one who has deep product understanding would be amazing as the chief growth officer. So we hired both. We hired one as the chief product officer, one as the chief growth officer. And combined, that's such a powerful combination because they know and understand each other. And therefore, when you're talking about client delivery, you can handle all the technical aspect, but all of the commercial and strategic aspect in one go, right? So we try not to get too processed or process orientated in that, like, this is a job description and this is your role and this is what we're hiring for. We find great people, we'll actually bring them on board for the gaps that we've identified. But to answer the specific questions, the interview process, sometimes it's very much a casual conversation because as a founder, one of the things I try to bring to the table is a huge degree of empathy. Just by natural personality trait, I like to understand people. I like to learn from them. I try to teach and mentor and develop as best as I can from my own experience and bring them to that journey. If that works both ways, then I know that that's going to resonate through the whole organization. And then we start bringing in a bit more formality when some of the people who are a bit more experienced than I am in formalized structured interviews will start putting them through the necessary steps to say, okay, have all the gates been actually crossed here as part of the selection process. So we try to be flexible in terms of the initial engagement and understanding the person and understanding their dynamics, but also understanding what they want out of this. It's not easy being part of a startup. It's even harder when you launch during COVID and 12 months later, you hit the funding winter, right? So you got to pick people who are tremendously resilient and tremendously passionate about the cause that we have, which is we want to drive financial inclusion by partnering up with platform ecosystems and delivering a seamless embedded finance experience.
I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of leaders, CEOs, CTOs, different spectrums, companies of various size, and definitely one recurring theme that I'm picking up also in the responses that you're sharing with us is that great leaders tend to structure their conversations with potential candidates in a way that really allows for that candidate to reveal their personality and their strengths and the passions versus just asking questions to see if I can trip you up and maybe catch you in a certain situation where you may not have the right knowledge or the right expertise. So that makes a lot of sense. And also what you've mentioned is really structuring that as a two-way conversation where you also provide the candidate an opportunity to ask you questions. I have the same, you know, equal of an interview of you. Whether that's, you know, you are the right leader, you're the right type of personality where I can succeed under. So that makes a lot of sense. Also, you've mentioned the challenges and the difficulties of growing and cultivating and managing that culture on a global scale with such a dispersed team all over the world. I believe your CTO is actually here in the States, right? Somewhere in Florida, not too far.
He's in Tampa, Florida, yeah.
Exactly. So you've mentioned some strategies where you try to bring the team together at least, you know, once or a couple of times a year. What else helps you maintain that open lines of communication and really continue cultivating that culture that you want to build while being so remote and well dispersed?
Yeah, I think what we do is we feed information to the team regularly. We have a structured call every Tuesday and every Friday, and that's really a download and an engagement opportunity. And that's really saying, hey, these customers have now come up, or where are we with this particular customer? And getting everyone involved across operations, across investment, across technology, across the commercial side. And what that does, it actually allows for a much of an inclusive dialogue across the firm, because people know and understand who the client is. People know and understand where they are in the implementation journey. They know and understand what the revenue outlook and the opportunity size is for that particular client. So when I mention a name, everyone's on the same page. Now, as we're developing the firm further, there's milestones of a new implementation. There's a milestone of a new funding round. There's a milestone of something unique or different happening. When you can transmit that message on a regular and ongoing basis, it means everyone's in on the same journey. And I think that's what's allowed us to, one, take an individual in a remote location to have a huge degree of trust to deliver their role every day, but to still feel part of the journey when it comes to every individual client that we're actually moving down the sales pipeline into an implementation, into a successful client and growth. And, you know, communication becomes key when borders are locked, right? It's like having a long distance relationship. And that's exactly what it is. It involves huge amounts of conversation and trust to ensure that you can actually pick up the phone and ask the question without hesitation, or have a bit of a challenging conversation and say, hey, has this been done or has it not? Or someone calls me up and says, hey, I relied on you as a contingency to deliver this. It's not ready. It's going to affect me. Where are you at? And I think that's been super helpful to make sure that everyone, they've spent time together, they've built relationships, they know that it's not a friction-filled conversation. It's about ensuring that we're policing each other, because we are on the same page. We are trying to be on the same journey and deliver together.
Last portion of every episode, I like to focus on you as an individual, as from a personal perspective. Yeah. Share with us your content diet. What are some sources or resources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself educated, informed on all of the things that are going on, not only in your industry, not only in your particular domain, but maybe something outside of that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm definitely a global macro junkie. I grew up on the trading desk at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, or on the trading floor, I should say. So really need to understand what's happening around the world. And, you know, some of the usual ports of call are the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times. And then I do read a few odd blogs here and there around the financial space. I think I try to get both sides of the equation. So I'll go a little bit extreme and read something like a Zero Hedge or a Seeking Alpha, where people have very particular views on a stock, on a trade, on a macro thesis. And then I'll try to get a bit more of the popular view, which is, hey, what is CNBC saying, or what is Bloomberg saying? So that's really around the market story and the thesis. In the world that I have to navigate is very much the VC investment space. SASTA is something that I'm pretty close to. I try to read that daily if I can just understand how other SaaS companies are doing, how the VC market's doing. I think one thing I do very frequently is I call up VCs like yourself and say, hey, let's bounce some ideas. What are you seeing? Here's what I'm seeing in Asia. So it gives me a very broad global context in the space that I'm in. And then last, it's really about understanding who our clients are and seeing what they're having to navigate, understanding supply chain disruptions and what that means for an e-commerce business. We get that as a live feed from our clients before it makes the news in 4 days' time, right? So that's really a great way for us to stay plugged in. So quite a variety. I'd say we, you know, consume a bit from the popular materials, and then, of course, a few of the boutique ones that are specialized. And then I try to go really deep into the VC space because I need to understand the logic and the thesis that does seem to change quite frequently in today's market to how we adapt our business. What are the metrics we need to hit? What's the run rate we need to achieve to actually continue?
To get a little bit more philosophical, I have a very loaded question for you. And
yeah,
in a way of what advice, or maybe series of advice that you would give to yourself when you were first starting out, whether that's in, you know, early 20s, when you're just out of college, knowing what you know now, what would be some of the things that, some of the lessons that you would share with yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'll just come back to the previous question, because you did ask me about me specifically, right? And I think what I've learned and what I've certainly seen from the market is that everyone loves to have that tall poppy or that one shining star or that one charismatic CEO that everyone can point to. And I don't necessarily think that's what success looks like. So whilst I become the voice of the firm and I become the face of the firm, every day I know very much it's about the team. So we do make sure that we maintain a degree of ego that recognizes that building a multi-billion dollar business is not about a single person. And we make sure that we all know and understand that someone needs to be that voice, someone needs to be the carrier of the culture, but very much all of us are responsible. So a lot of the media work that's going on within our organization is actually being conducted by Kaya, who's our chief investment officer. She's on Bloomberg, she's on CNBC, she's on a variety of different spaces. Every time there's a conference opportunity, hey, Vikram, you're going here, or Dinesh, it's in the US, you're going here. So what we try to do is make sure that the market knows that it's not just the one guy, it's not just the one voice, it's a collective, it's a team effort, right? And that comes back to the question you just asked, what's the advice that I'd give myself as a 24, 23-year-old? Surround yourself with people who are much older and wiser than you are, because that's where you're going to get all the learning. Now, thankfully, I learned that quickly enough to surround myself around great leaders. So some of the leadership qualities I exhibit are nothing more than reflection of knowing what to do, but also knowing what not to do, having gone through the experiences I did with my bosses. But on a aggregate basis, my leaders were always great for my development, and they were very positive in helping shape me as an individual. So a lot of that resonates through to who I am today. And then because they were much older and much wiser, that learning is just tremendous, because you're not going to make your own mistakes on your own watch. You've gone through that journey, understood someone else's experiences, hopefully learned from it and not implemented those mistakes while you're actually trying to build an organization for yourself. So I think a lot of startups, particularly with young founders, probably take too long to bring the senior guys in. Right. And, you know, we've seen that with much more mature firms who are now in their multi-billion stage. And you can even use Facebook as an example, right? Sheryl coming in and a few of the other senior people coming into the organization was almost 5 years after the company had started and was already successful in its own right. But it could have come a lot earlier to bring some of that structure and that organization and that process that you see with much larger organizations. So I'm glad we did that with a degree of success. Of course, as I mentioned, sometimes it can be a bit of a blind spot, so you just got to remain a bit balanced.
That's very powerful, and definitely thank you for sharing that. And just overall, I appreciate this very wonderful conversation, very short, insightful. I personally learned quite a bit. I definitely thank you for your time, and I'm actually looking forward to seeing you again in Singapore, and enjoy all of the amazing food that you guys have over there. So definitely thank you.
No, likewise. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.